Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen speaking, this time with two Mind Web stories. The first time around, it's a story from New Worlds of Fantasy number 2, edited by Terry Carr. It's Britt Schweitzer's En Passant. My head struck the ground with a dull thud, and then rolled 8 or 9 feet into a small cluster of weeds. It's difficult to describe the dizzy blur of colors and shapes I witnessed as this event took place, but the discomfort I experienced can be readily imagined. The impact upon striking the ground was so severe that I remained in a dazed, semi-conscious state for a considerable time thereafter. I do not know, in fact, how long it was before my senses were again fully operative. My first clear impression was of some insect roaming aimlessly over the side of my face, a tormentor against whom I seemed quite helpless, until it made the error of crawling too close to my mouth, whereupon, with a shudder, I spat him away. This encounter was sufficient to revive me to full consciousness. I became aware of a throbbing pain on the left side of my head, a little above and to the right of the ear, a pain which brought the memory of my unfortunate topple into grim focus, and led me to an awareness of the difficult situation in which, as a result, I found myself. I gazed around and saw only earth and sky. I listened intently for several moments, but heard nothing. Looking again at my surroundings, I noticed in the extreme corner of my limited view the presence of a shadow. Inasmuch as my visual angle to the ground was extremely awkward, I was unable to make out the details, but it seemed to be a figure of some kind, perhaps human. I tried to shift my position in such a way that the figure would come into view. After some experimentation, I found that I was able to pivot my head around by careful movement of the jaws. Soon there emerged into sight the figure of a man standing in frozen stride. With relief, I called out, but he made no sound or motion in response. I examined the still figure more closely and noticed with a sudden start that it was headless. I was watching my own body. After recovering from the initial surprise, I became fascinated with the idea of viewing my figure from such an unusual aspect. I examined it with interest for several minutes before my thoughts returned again to the gravity of my predicament. It was good, certainly, that my entire being was now accounted for, but there was still the problem of reuniting the parts. I called out again to the motionless figure, but there was no response. I shouted several times, hoping to stir it to action on its own behalf, but soon realized that any attempt at communication would prove futile. I paused to study the body again, and it occurred to me that I had never before been able to view myself from such a convenient angle, and with complete objectivity, as if examining the figure of another person. My mind returned abruptly, however, to the serious problem with which I was confronted. Being myself altogether immobile, any hope of restoration seemed to lie in gaining assistance from a second party. I began to shout very loudly for help, but my efforts were useless. A sense of panic swept over me as I began to contemplate my helplessness. As there was no other living thing in view, it appeared that I might be destined to remain thus in repose for some considerable time. I assured myself, however, that someone would eventually happen to pass by and, seeing the situation, offer assistance. I decided to wait. I waited for several days. During that time, I spent many hours absorbed in the study of my torso. As the sun moved through its daily course, varying patterns of light would fall on the figure, thus presenting a marvelous panorama of shadow and flesh. I came to know the contour of every muscle, every misshape, every blemish. I was disappointed to realize that, in honest appraisal, my form was rather unexceptional. No worse than average, to be sure, but hardly statuesque. It presented, nevertheless, a remarkable image from which could be studied the rhythmic action of each muscle poised in the arrested motion of a single instant. I eventually began to lose hope that anyone would ever pass that particular place, and it seemed for a moment that I might be fated to spend eternity in visual contemplation of my headless body. It seemed curious that not one person should have passed after so long a time, and the thought occurred to me that the same fate which had struck me to immobility might have befallen every living thing. Perhaps the world was now populated by countless heads scattered at isolated intervals, each in contemplation of its own detached body, each vainly hoping for the chance passing of another. Perhaps this was the way the universe was to end, with its living thing so tirelessly and meticulously developed, now cast into a pattern of helpless absurdity. Well, having finally abandoned all hope of rescue, I began to consider a plan whereby I might improve my own situation. I had discovered during the days of waiting that I was not altogether incapable of movement, that with proper action of my jaws, I could propel myself somewhat in the manner of a snake. The motion was slow, almost imperceptible, but it seemed to offer the only faint hope of altering my situation. In this manner, I set out to bring head and body closer together. I soon discovered that the task was extraordinarily difficult. Movement was slow and by no means easy to control. Indeed, it was quite difficult to avoid an aimless zigzag path, and it was several days before I became certain that definite progress was being made. Moreover, the effort was quite exhausting, and my muscles soon began to ache unbearably. Although I made no attempt to keep track of time, it was many days before I had covered even half the distance, and I was by then near a state of collapse. The sight of my figure began to infuriate me, fresh and vigorous looking as it was, yet not contributing one iota in the struggle for its own preservation. At one point, in fact, in an almost delirious rage, I found myself cursing at it violently. "You foolish ass, why don't you do something to help?" When I had at last reached a position directly under my body, I began to wonder whether my arduous labors would prove to be of any practical use. It was reassuring to finally touch its flesh after such a lengthy separation, but I found that I was not able to stir it in the least. It remained quite unmoved, even when bitten vigorously. Moreover, I was unable to topple it with even the most strenuous exertion. I rested for several days in order to recover my strength, and at the same time attempted to work out a solution to my awkward problem. Gradually, I conceived the details of a fantastic plan whereby, if successful, I might be eventually on my way again in one piece. My scheme was simply to gain a firm grip on one of my legs and slowly work my way upwards by means of lateral movements of the jaw. When this thought first occurred to me, I dismissed it as absurdly impractical, but ultimately decided that it must be tried as no other possibility remained. My experiences in ground propulsion already forewarned me that such an endeavor would require every ounce of stamina and strength I could muster, and would necessarily have to be planned with great care if there was to be any hope of success. Having carefully surveyed the terrain of flesh and determined a feasible route, I began with considerable trepidation my upward journey. I started at the heel of my left foot and soon developed a workable technique by means of which I was able to gain ascent. My method consisted in clamping my jaws firmly around the flesh to obtain support, then sliding the lower jaw upwards a slight distance, and then moving the upper jaw to a position adjoining it. Since it was necessary to maintain a secure grip at every instant in order to continuously support the weight of my head, I could not avoid inflicting injury to my body along the path of travel. As I felt the skin being sheared beneath my clamped jaws and occasionally tasted a warm trickle of blood, I was rather thankful that nervous communication to that portion of my anatomy was, for the time being, severed. It was imperative to proceed relentlessly and without pause once the endeavor had begun, since the mere act of support consumed precious energy even when my head was not in motion. My initial progress was greater than I had originally anticipated, and I managed to reach a position just below the rear knee joint in about 5 hours. At this point, I became overly confident, however, and failed to judge properly the narrowing path of flesh in this area. My grip loosened for a split second, and my head toppled once again to earth. My first attempt had failed. My initial trial gave me a degree of confidence, however, and after a day of rest, I began a second journey, determined this time to succeed at all costs. I debated for some while the choice of route for my second try. The previous path had been a good one, but I hesitated to inflict further damage on those areas of flesh which had already been severely lacerated. So I decided finally to begin at the right leg. I was able in my second effort to reach the buttocks after one day of travel. My jaws were by that time tired and numb, and I feared I might lose control over their movements. Yet I had no choice but to continue as long as any vestige of strength remained. I had planned, as an intermediate objective, to reach a point just above my slightly extended left forearm. Working my way up behind the ribs, I endeavored to arrive at a position in which the weight of my head would be supported in a fork formed by the arm and lower chest. I was in a state of near collapse when I finally managed to work my way securely into this refuge. The relief I felt as I relaxed my jaws for the first time in 2 days is impossible to describe. As I dozed off in a sound sleep with my head tucked firmly under my arm, I couldn't help chuckling slightly at the thought of the absurd spectacle I must have then presented. Taking full advantage of the opportunity, I rested in that spot for several days. When my aching jaws finally began to regain their strength, I contemplated the final lap of my journey. I elected to continue by way of a path up the right front of my body, keeping close to the side until I neared the shoulder. It was considerably more difficult than before to maintain a firm grip, owing to the lack of ample flesh around my upper rib cage. Several times the thought struck me that I might again topple with my objective so close at hand, and I doubted whether I could muster the courage to begin a third time should this happen. Ultimately, I reached shoulder level, and with some relief began traveling across towards the neck. My collarbone provided a convenient ledge on which to gain a grip, and I reached the throat with little difficulty. I was then confronted by what proved to be the most difficult task of the entire project, that of rejoining my head at the proper position without losing my support in the process. Maintaining a tenacious grip on my own throat, I began to determine the effect of various movements of my jaw and facial muscles. I was extremely discouraged at first to realize that even with the most strenuous exertion, I was unable to orient my head at more than half the angle required for proper reinstatement. Though I twisted and turned it every conceivable direction, all efforts seemed futile. A sense of despair swept over me as it began to appear that after all my labors, final success was to be denied. I found that matters could be improved considerably, however, by moving around to the side of the neck and forcing its upper surface to tilt slightly by severe compression of its flesh between my teeth. It was with some regret that I performed this maneuver, as I was apprehensive of the possibility that the wounds I was inflicting might prove mortal. Yet this procedure, despite its grave risk, seemed to offer the only hope of eventual success. Straining every available muscle to the utmost, I was able to force the severed surfaces gradually nearer and nearer to one another. When contact was finally achieved, the pain of all the horrible lacerations which I had been forced to inflict on myself shot through me in an excruciating rage. The thrill of feeling myself again whole, however, made the suffering seem inconsequential. As I caused my limbs to move for the first time in many weeks, I discovered, with sudden shock, that my head was on backwards. This fact proved to be less serious than amusing, however. With arms now at my control, it was a simple matter to reach up and twist it to the right position. Having done this, I paused for an instant to breathe a sigh of relief. Now that this extraordinary incident in my life had come to a close. Then, with renewed vigor, I continued my interrupted journey, determined henceforth to remain indoors on windy days. The title of that short piece was En Passant by Britt Schweitzer. It's from New Worlds of Fantasy number 2, edited by Terry Carr. Thank you. This edition of Mind Webs keeps rolling now with our second story of this session. It's Isaac Asimov's Dream World, and it's from Ida Purnell Stone's Never in This World. Edward Keller had been a science fiction devotee for 4 years. He bubbled with galactic enthusiasm. His Aunt Clara, who had brought him up by rule and rod in pious memory of her deceased sister, wavered between toleration and exasperation. It appalled her to watch him grow so immersed in fantasy.
"Face reality, Eddie,"
she would say angrily. He would nod, but go on. "And I dream Martians were chasing me, see? I had a special death ray, but the atomic power unit was pretty low, and..." Every other breakfast consisted of eggs, toast, milk, and some such dream. Aunt Clara said severely,
"Now, Eddie, one of these nights you won't be able to wake up out of your dream. You'll be trapped. Then what?"
She lowered her angular face close to his and glared. Eddie was strangely impressed by his aunt's warning. He lay in bed staring into the darkness. He wouldn't like to be trapped in a dream. It was always nice to wake up before it was too late, like the time the dinosaurs were after him. Suddenly, he was out of bed, out of the house, out on the lawn, and he knew it was another dream. The thought was broken by a vague thunder and a shadow that blotted the sun. He looked upward in astonishment, and he could make out the human face that touched the clouds. It was his Aunt Clara. Monstrously tall, she bent toward him in admonition, mast-like forefinger upraised, voice too guttural to be made out. Eddie turned and ran in panic. Another Aunt Clara monster loomed up before him, voice rumbling. He turned again, stumbling, panting, heading outward, outward. He reached the top of the hill and stopped in horror. Off in the distance, 100 towering Aunt Claras were marching by. As the column passed, each line of Aunt Clara's turned their head sharply toward him, and the thunderous bass rumbling coalesced into words.
"Face reality, Eddie. Face 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 reality, Eddie."
Eddie threw himself sobbing to the ground.
"Please wake up," he begged himself. "Please wake up. Don't be caught in this dream."
For unless he woke up, the worst science fictional doom of all would have overtaken him. He would be trapped, trapped in a world of giant ants.
Thank you.
That story, the second one of this session, was titled Dream World. Written by Isaac Asimov, it shows up in Never in This World, edited by Idella Purnell Stone. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for MindWebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff. MindWebs comes to you from WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.